Глобальная прачечная, как банки Британии и Германии.
Схеме под условным названием «Ландромат».
Почему центром «Ландромата» стал именно...
И другой бенефициар «Ландромата».
Дело под названием «Всемирная прачечная» или...
Billions of dollars in black Russian cash siphoned through thousands of companies with accounts at hundreds of banks in scores of countries. A massive money laundromat exposed. An important investigation released this week by the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project pulled back the curtain on how Russian officials and organized crime figures wash their money. And it also raises disturbing questions about what these billions are being used for. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio, keeping us in the Enlightenment zone, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Happy to be enlightening.
We're always happy to have you keeping us in the Enlightenment zone, as you always do. And joining us from Buenos Aires, Argentina, is investigative journalist Paul Radu, co-founder of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project and the lead investigator on this week's report. Welcome to the podcast, Paul. Congratulations on an excellent report, and thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for coming. And for those who haven't read the report, and shame on them, Paul, can you give us a quick summary of your findings? How did this so-called money laundromat work? You've been investigating this kind of thing for a long time now. Did anything you see in this surprise you?
Well, yes and no. It's always a surprise you to see how these criminals work. It's we first exposed the laundromat in 2014. Mm-hmm. That's when we came across this web of companies. So it's a web of companies and bank accounts. Most of these companies are faceless, ghost, offshore type of companies with no beneficial ownership. And they have these bank accounts, you know, in Russian banks, in one bank in Moldova, as well as a bank in Latvia that is called Trasta Commerzbanka. So this web of companies, of faceless companies, was used to move out of Russia a bit more than $20 billion in black money. All the operation was really well coordinated, was a very interesting setup that ensured deniability at every step of the operation. So if you look at the Russian banks involved, and there are about 19 Russian banks, including, for instance, the bank that gave to Marine Le Pen the famous loan a few years back. So most of these Russian banks were shut down back in Russia for money laundering. The companies that had the bank accounts in these banks are the same type of faceless ghost companies, you know, like the ones involved on the Western European or U.S. side. So it was a system designed as Tor, as this anonymity tool that you can use on the internet, the Onion router. So it was to ensure deniability at every step, and it was to allow rich and powerful Russians to move billions and billions of dollars out of the country, and this money was used for various types of purposes. Now we looked very hard for 3 years now at this what we dubbed the Russian laundromat, and some of the expenses in the laundromat are, you know, to be expected. Like you see these Russians, you know, rich Russians buying property in the West. You see them paying for their kids' schooling in the UK, in other parts. You see, you know, a lot of the money spent on luxury watches, yachts, and all these type of expenses that we always, you know, assume when we talk about corrupt Russian oligarchs. But then there are lots of payments that are not connected to this type of buyings. These are money. For instance, we came across a case where a California-based company that is owned by a Russian citizen, the company is called Trident International, was used to import electronics, to export electronics out of the United States, electronics for which you need a license. This would be various pieces of technology that can be used, you know, in the satellite imagery in the industry. And then then if you look closer to this company, you'll see that it's directly connected to the Russian military industry, to companies that are attached to the Russian military and to the Russian intelligence agencies. So it's a system that was designed, you know, for all types of payments, and it was designed to obscure sometimes, you know, the real reason why this money was sent abroad from Russia.
Uh-huh. Now, there, you also noted that this ingenious method of using the Moldovan justice system to help wash this money. Can you flesh that out a little for us? Because I thought that part was really interesting.
Sure. I mean, all these money transfers are based on pieces of paper that are called promissory notes or bill of exchanges. These are really pieces of A4 paper that say company A, and usually company A is a company based in the UK or in Delaware in the US, owes all this money to company B. And the amounts vary from $80 million to $580 million. So this piece of paper is valued at, say, $580 million. Now, the trick with this is that the names of the companies on the promissory notes are misspelled. There's always one letter missing. You know, the signatories on these bills of exchanges or promissory notes, their names are always misspelled, also to ensure, again, deniability. But if you switch this piece of paper over, what you see is that at some point in time, company A says, look, actually, you know, this money is owed to me by these Russian companies. And then you see, you know, a number of Russian companies, 5, 6, 8 sometimes, plus one Moldovan citizen. So there's always some Moldovan citizen that owes money to this offshore company based in the UK or elsewhere. Now, we talk to these Moldovan citizens, you know, and we track down the Russian companies. The Moldovan citizens, you know, are people that have no idea that they owe this money because they've never done business with these companies, and they are from villages in Moldova. They are really, really poor. So this is, you know, where the Moldovan justice system comes in, because the criminals needed these promissory notes. So all the money, you know, was transferred based on these promissory notes that were certified in a Moldovan court, because now there was jurisdiction for these fictitious loans, because one Moldovan citizen was, wow, you know, mentioned on the back of the promissory note. So they used this trick to bring this to court in Moldova. In Moldova, there were judges that didn't even bother to look at the promissory notes, because it was so clear that these pieces of paper were worth nothing. They were, you know, I mean, there were lots of errors on pieces of paper that were, you know, worth, you know, fictitiously $580 million U.S. dollars.
So, I mean, so basically the Moldovan courts pretty much certify that this is clean money at the end of the day, right? This is how it works. I mean, this is like a massive conspiracy. If you're talking the amount of judges involved, the amount of banks involved. Mark, you've been, you know, crime and corruption, you're kind of your wheelhorse. What did you walk away from in this report?
Well, I mean, obviously the first thing it's worth mentioning is just simply the sheer scale. I mean, this report talks about just over $20 billion. There's now suggestions that actually it could be more like $80 billion. I mean, this is huge sums of money, inevitably. And anyway, that kind of money has, it's like a black hole. It has a gravitational force all of its own. Even, as it were, the sort of the small rounding errors actually become sort of huge amounts. And I mean, I know we'll be talking more about sort of how the Russian state might use this. And I think this is where the sort of, as it were, the state comes in as well as corruption. I think I'd really want to kind of raise a couple of points. I mean, one of them is, look, this is, you know, a clear demonstration of the extraordinary extent to which corruption is one of the greatest security threats of the modern age, and certainly to Western transparent liberal societies. I mean, I know, Brian, you sort of sometimes say, you know, corruption is the new communism.
The Kremlin's black cash is the new red menace. I can't say it enough because I think it needs to be stressed a lot.
Well, you see, except, I mean, in some ways, I mean, it's not that I would disagree, but I think I want to kind of broaden the focus and firstly make it clear that this is not, unfortunately, something that is being done to us. It is something that we are enthusiastically doing to ourselves.
That's a point I made on yesterday's Daily Vertical.
But at the same time, it's not just the Russians. I mean, I think this is it. We create vulnerabilities that actually can and are exploited by all kinds of other actors, whether we're talking Middle Eastern petrodollars or China or whoever. I mean, unfortunately, this is a problem. So actually, what this has very valuably demonstrated has been precisely that vulnerability. Second point I think I'd want to make with that is, who is ultimately losing the most from this? And the answer is Russia. Many individual Russians. Many individual Russians are doing exceedingly well out of this. But Russia as a country, as a society, and indeed as a state, is suffering because this is money that is being transferred out at the very, very time when the regime is desperate to try and repatriate funds. And again, I think what this shows is the extent to which there is this very, very stark tension in Russia between what people know is right for the country and what they're actually willing to put up with for themselves, for their friends, for the people in their inner circle. Because this is something that could not be happening without the connivance of many people within the state. You do not just happen to not notice $20 to $80 billion.
I think this is something that couldn't happen without the connivance of the very, very top.
Exactly, and in the same way as, you know, these are the people who say that corruption is a moral ill, while busy building themselves grandiose dachas and such like, and allowing their friends to do exactly the same. So, I mean, I think one of the fascinating stories about this is that on the one hand, it's something that actually is clearly an instrument that can be used by the Kremlin. But on the other hand, it's actually that the Kremlin, because of the degree to which Russia is a kleptocracy, is also essentially trashing Russia.
No, I would agree with that. And in terms of going back to your comment that it's not just Russia, I agree with you, it's not just Russia. But Russia is relatively unique in this case, in that Russia is explicitly trying to undermine Western liberal democracy. And so it's not only Russia that's laundering money through the West and corrupting our system that way, but at the same time, they are using this to a degree to as one of the tools that they use to undermine us. On your second point, I'd say, I mean, this shows the tension and the collusion between what you like to call kleptocratic Russia and ideological Russia. And going back to your old concept of the three Russian states, the normal state, the kleptocratic state, and the ideological state. I mean, in some ways, there is tension here between the kleptocratic and the ideological state, but I would also say this is also somewhat of a case where the ideological state and the kleptocratic state overlap. Because if, as you put it, a rounding error from this massive sum of money that could be as much as $80 billion, it can be at the Kremlin's disposal to use for various shenanigans in Europe, then this is something that can be used at the disposal of the ideological state of Putin's
goals. Sure, but I mean, they're each hostages of the other. I mean,
yes.
Absolutely. They're each gaining from this, but they're also actually each losing.
Paul, I see you want to get in here. Please.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's not just the Russians. When we started investigating, you know, the laundromat, we came, for instance, across this banking record of a company called Tormex. Tormex is a company based in New Zealand with bank accounts in Latvia. This company was used to launder Russian money, but it laundered at the same time Sinaloa money. This is one of the most powerful drug cartels in Mexico. It laundered Vietnamese organized crime money. And it laundered Magnitsky money. So what you see is these platforms in Eastern Europe that are used for money laundering for lots of criminal groups, not just the Russians. On the other hand, you know, when you look at this and you see, you know, the potential of that Russia has, you know, the Russian government rather has to influence, you know, elections abroad and all, you know, to destroy the West. You have glimpses of what was going on in the 70s and the 80s. I'm coming from Romania, and I've studied this for quite a bit. I investigated how Romania came to 89 without any foreign debt. That debt was paid at the expense of the people and all that, but part of that was actually lots of money laundering operation from drug trafficking. So if you look at that, you know, and you look at nowadays, you see that things are a bit similar.
Mm. Although now the capacity to do this, I would imagine, is much greater than it was in the 70s. But I want to stick with you, Paul, in this and kind of get into some of the details in this. You have a whole section on who were the super users of this laundromat. Who were they, and what does that say about this whole enterprise? Who were these super users?
So these are rich Russian oligarchs connected to power who have contracts with the state, with the Russian state. So most of their money comes from the state, from the Russians themselves. If you actually look at what we call super users, and these are three persons, and if you count the money that they dealt with inside the laundromat, this is still, you know, peanuts. I mean, we're talking about a few hundred million US dollars. So there are other users that we weren't able to identify. And I think this is the point where, you know, banks could come in. It's why we singled out banks in this, because this is, you know, international banks had a big, big say in all this. I mean, they allowed this pipeline, this money pipeline to function. They allowed the Russian laundromat. So now they have to find out where this money went, you know, because even inside this 20 billion some law enforcement say it's 80 billion or 100 billion. Even inside this, we only know where a small portion went. So these Russian super users, you know, use some of the money to import goods into Russia, you know, to better their lives, to, you know. But there's lots of money out there that are not accounted, you know, and we need to track down that money, because that's where the big problems lie. You know?
Yeah, no, this is where I want to go in the second half. Mark, what are the heavy users of this have? What jumped out at you about that? Anything?
Well, can I just make one point first? Going back to Paul's point about sort of the multiplicity of different people involved. I mean, I was also thinking back to the notorious, though now overshadowed, Bank of New York money laundering scam,
yes,
which again was essentially a Russian deal, most of which was capital flight rather than actual sort of what we think of as organized crime money. But the interesting thing was precisely that once they'd established this laundry, this industrial scale laundry, they in a way threw it open to who else wants to get involved, and we had Italian mafia money flowing through it and so forth. Relatively small amounts compared with the sort of the main business that was coming from Russia. But again, I think it says something about the essential extent to which, just as upper world trade and commerce is globalized, so too underworld flows are much the same. But going back to this business of the super users, yeah, I mean, it makes me wonder about, you know, whether or not these are the people who run it. These are the people who just simply sort of, you know, benefited from it. Are they simply the people who had the technical skills to set it up? Because obviously this is a very, very sophisticated operation. But also, how far are these the equivalent of the Moldovan farmers who have to fulfill a certain function? They have to be in some ways kind of communication things. And again, I'm going to use the parallel when one looks at organized crime groups. One of the classic ways one looks at organized crime groups is through social network analysis. How many people, you know, forms of communication, and you tend to assume that someone who is in the most connection with the most members of the gang is important. And often they are. But in some cases, actually what you end up identifying is in some ways the gang leader's secretary or cutout.
Uh-huh.
It is the person whose job is there to actually be the relay station, the switchboard. And so, again, I think this is why I would emphatically underline what Paul said about the fact that, however, I mean, this is an extraordinary bit of investigation, but nonetheless, it's only the first stage. And the next stage is one that actually, you know, in fairness, it's, I wouldn't say it's impossible, but it's hard for people like OCCRP and the journalists to do. I mean, this is now where banks and states have to come in, because it's, you know, it has these issues of access and jurisdiction that are really crucial, I would say.
Mm. That's a good segue, because I did want to talk about the Western banks, and they were some of the most prestigious banks in the West we're talking about here. And it wasn't really clear to me as I read it, and I think there's a reason for that, Paul. But what was your sense? Were the Western banks that participated in this willing participants, or were they duped? What did this look like to you? Because this was it's hard for me to believe that you could pull the wool over the eye of a bank. Maybe I'm just naive. I don't know a lot about the financial world, but what was your sense there?
Well, I mean, we obviously talked to the banks, and we're talking to banks for a long time. And what's for sure is that the criminals are very, very smart, and the banks, some of the banks admitted that they haven't done their due diligence. They said they were oversmart, basically, by the criminals. For instance, Deutsche Bank said that since this happened, they hired a bit more than 1,000 people in their compliance department. So they hired 1,000 investigators to track down such schemes. Now, if you actually look at the scheme itself, you'd see that in order to find that these companies don't have a beneficial owner, which is a requirement for banks, you know, they have to know the beneficial owner of a bank account, right? They have to know who's sending them the money. So it takes about 5 minutes to realize that everybody involved with the company, and in our reporting, we gave the example of one of the companies that is called Westbourne Enterprises, a Scottish LP, limited partnership. So these had no real owners. And it takes 5 minutes to find this out from the company's house in London on the website that is open to everybody, you know, and that can be checked, you know, like in 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. So you'll see that the directors and the shareholders of this company are dummies, you know, that they have at the same time, they're directors and shareholders in hundreds of other companies. And that the company doesn't have any physical offices or something. So it's really easy to investigate. You don't need 1,000 people, you know, this. And this was these were recurrent transfers. I mean, when you see in your bank accounts hundreds of millions coming on the same reasoning, this is, you know, for electronics, and this is for construction equipment. And, you know, spaced with like 15 minutes, you get, you know, 100 million, 20 million, 1 million and all that. I mean, that should tell you that something is going on. And again, it only takes a few minutes to check it and to realize, wait, this is not a real company, you know?
And yet it wasn't checked, and this has been going on from 2011 to 2014, right? I mean, that's deeply disturbing. Mark, I see you're writing. I bet you're disturbed, too.
Disturbed, if not necessarily surprised. I mean, I think the problem is, I mean, it's interesting that, in fact, I mean, what we see at the moment is this sort of general industry-wide trend to what's called risk-based money laundering regimes, which is essentially sort of trying to sort of get people to think, well, does this look as if it should be risky? Interestingly, the three main European regulatory agencies have very recently actually issued a warning that actually this is making the money laundering regime less robust, not more robust. The bottom line is this is business. And, you know, clearly there is always an impulse to doing business, and no one really wants to be the person who says, you know, this goose that is laying golden eggs, you know, actually there may be a problem with this. I mean, I'm sure things have moved on. I remember someone I knew some time back who worked in compliance said that one of their jobs, one which she didn't stay in for long, precisely, so she was actually told, look, your job is not actually to make sure we comply. Your job is to make sure no one can prove we didn't. And unfortunately, I think that although clearly that there has been a certain degree of cultural shift, it's only a certain degree. And this is the problem nowadays, that, you know, actually, given that money flows so freely, and that no one, and I say this as a British passport holder, no one is willing to turn down the huge opportunities of being a hub in the financial sector, then in some ways, you know, actually what happens is you tend to find, you know, particular scandals and cases creates a short-lived furore, but frankly, bonuses happen every year. Mm. And the natural impulse is to go back to, as long as, you know, if someone turns up with a suitcase full of cocaine smeared dollar bills, then okay, at that point they'll be thinking there's something dubious here. But as long as people have gone through, as it were, the effort and the courtesy of looking professional, having a good story, at least making it to the point where when you're told, you can say, I was shocked to discover that this was dirty money, then actually, frankly, the impulse is to go along with it. And I think this is the whole problem of basically allowing financial systems to be largely self-regulating. Mm. No one wants to do the job.
So as long as there's plausible deniability for the legitimate end of this, i.e. the banks, then it's going to continue.
And particularly because in some ways, I mean, in a way, the problem in this respect is that the sums are so great. It's not just that, therefore, it's so, so tempting. It's that, if someone comes along and they're trying to move $11,000, in other words, over the general reporting limit, then you might well think, well, this, you know, this could be terrorist money, this could be criminal money or whatever. This is such huge sums that almost by definition it is kind of respectable. In other words, it's not coming from an individual gangster or terrorist. It's really coming from sort of corporate oligarchic or state structures.
So you're saying laundering $11,000 is suspicious and laundering $80 billion is respectable?
Well, the same way as, let's be honest, robbing a post office at gunpoint and stealing $1,000 will get you a much, much worse fine than defrauding $100 million.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I wanted to hit on, and this kind of flows from this, and I wanted to get your... go ahead, Paul.
I was actually going to say that... in some cases, you know, because I'm also talking to compliance people, you know, in banks. So some of the compliance people in the banks that receive the money flagged these transactions, but the executives of the banks ignored the flagging. So they issued the so-called suspicious activity reports, but these were largely ignored. So this is also a problem. And Mark is right. You know, I mean, banks want the money. Banks want the business, and banks can choose to ignore, you know, the red flags attached to this kind of money, to the billions.
Well, I want to stick with you, Paul, and kind of go with something that kind of logically flows from this, and that this is, I mean, this report yet again has resulted in calls for tightening our money laundering regulations, tightening our financial regulations, and so on. You must talk to a lot of regulators in the course of your investigations here. What are some of the things that Western governments can do to plug these holes, given that there's the political will to do so?
It's not only that we or we at OCCRP talk to these people. It's we also train them. We organize workshops with compliance, with banking compliance people, you know, and we train them. Our next one is going to be actually in Switzerland, in Basel, in a few weeks. Our next workshop. But so what they need is to handle a lot better the open source information that is out there. They rely a lot on law enforcement, and law enforcement is very, very slow in acting. I mean, it takes them sometimes months to get a company record to see who's the beneficial owner of a company, while the same work can be done in 2 minutes, you know, because they go through, you know, these MLATs, you know, the mutual legal assistance treaties and all that. And you could do a lot online beforehand. And some of them are not very well prepared with this. Some of them are really willing to learn how to do this because it's a trade, basically. And things are moving very, very quickly. I mean, you'd say that there's more and more open information out there. So you should be able to follow the money in an easier manner. But lots of these people are not trained to do so, and they can't really handle this type of. I mean, because if you look at the criminals, at the people who put together all this, and one of them is actually right now arrested in Moldova. If you look at his profile, this guy was traveling all the time. He was crossing borders all the time. He gathered a lot of knowledge from lots of geographies, and this guy needs to be, you know, investigated by a prosecutor who sits in an office and doesn't leave a city for, you know, for years and years. I mean, experience, the difference in experiences, or someone in compliance who, again, doesn't travel, doesn't know the world, you know. I mean, obviously, the people that organize the laundromat are much better prepared than these people. So even there, there's a lack of balance, you know. You can't investigate something that is put together by really smart people and people who have the network at their disposal and who have the money to create the network, and then you expect someone, you know, who works outside of the networks, you know, and inside confined to these national boundaries, you know, and it's just an unequal fight there.
Mark, you know quite a bit about law enforcement. What can you add to that?
I think one of the key problems is, again, whose job is it to do this? Law enforcement. Primarily speaking, their role is to keep the streets quiet. I mean, I'm caricaturing, but that if they don't do that, that's when you get people complaining. And obviously then the kind of criminality that directly impacts the drug traffickers, the gun traffickers, the people traffickers, as well as just simply the sort of the street gangs and the ordinary just sort of day-to-day crime that is the overwhelming majority. The kind of investigations we're talking about are phenomenally time and resource intensive. I mean, even just look at the consortium of different sort of newspapers and journalists that actually the OCCRP brought together for this. To actually then think we are going to put that kind of resource into crime that is unlikely to be precisely impacting the streets and impacting ordinary citizens' day-to-day lives, and which is also probably benefiting many of the countries through which the money flows. I mean, if the money is just flowing through your jurisdiction, some of your people will get nice fees from it, and then, you know, there may be sort of taxes and other duties, and then it moves on. And if it's going to do any bad stuff, it's done it where it was generated, and it'll do it where it ends up. But it's just passing through, and it's just business. So again, I think we come back to this problem of whose job is it? I mean, I was interested that Paul was saying how they train compliance officers, and that's great. But part of me thinks they ought to actually also be training CEOs and CFOs. Because even the compliance officers, they actually have a very, very specific and focused role within the financial institutions. Well, likewise, police only have a very specific role within
Although
the administration of a government.
Although police's role is to enforce the law. And money laundering, last time I checked, was illegal.
Yeah, but when it comes down to it, I mean, there will always be more crimes than the police can investigate. There will always be more demands on the police's resources and time. And, you know, how far can you really make the case that a sort of a major investment in an anti, sort of what is presumed to be a money laundering case, is worth taking away resources from, for example, immediately trying to track down the assets of drug traffickers?
Yeah, although I would say if some journalists and not can get to the bottom of this relatively quickly, if we're talking about the time span it takes for law enforcement, would think that states
but bear
would
in mind
have the
that
capacity
states
to
have
this.
To take things to trial. The purpose of a state investigation is not just simply to say, hey, we feel comfortable saying this and that no one's going to sue us for libel. States actually have to be able to put it in a way and say, we have done this, followed all these steps and done everything in such a way that we have a pretty decent chance that we're going to get someone up to trial. Otherwise, it's wasted. Intelligence agencies, now, this is just one last point I wanted to make. Intelligence agencies are different. And in a way, it's quite striking that actually the extent to which intelligence agencies have, and this is not, in everybody's case, but frankly, generally speaking, have failed to really take advantage of their capacity to disrupt. Because, yes, intelligence agencies, they can't take people to court generally, but that doesn't matter. All they need to do is disrupt. And so much of these kind of schemes depend on certain levels of trust. And that's one area in which actually intelligence agencies can step in. But again, I think actually this is not the kind of thing. At the moment, there is this huge drive towards terrorist funding, which actually tends to sort of soak up the best and the brightest of the relatively few intelligence officers who understand financial flows and are free to do that.
So like so much that the threat from the South is trumping the threat from the East in a lot of ways, if you put it that way. Paul, last word before we move on to the next section.
Yeah, just to add on that, I mean, Mark is right. There is no enemy at the transnational level for organized crime. There is no global intelligence agency. There is no global law enforcement agency. This being said, even national law enforcement can do a lot more. And again, indeed, you have to gather evidence that sticks in court. But imagine this short scenario. You find out that a company from Cyprus is involved in money laundering. You are the police in the UK. Now, you need to file an MLAT with Cyprus. This is the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, right? To find out who are the owners of this company in Cyprus. And then you find out that the company in Cyprus is owned by a company in the Seychelles. So you have to do the same thing with the Seychelles. And then you find out that the company in Seychelles is owned by a Russian company, and so on and so on. Now, the idea is that the time that you're going to spend in waiting for these, results to come in, the organized crime is going to be, far away from you at that point. So what we're doing with law enforcement is we're teaching them to do this sort of work beforehand, so and to file the MLATs at the same time, so that it doesn't take a long time. So this shortens the time for the investigation greatly. Now, on the other hand, this is largely perceived as a victimless crime, money laundering. You say money laundering, it's money moved from point A to point B. But if you look at the laundromat, at the Russian laundromat, you'll see, for instance, that, for instance, in one case, there's one bank in Russia called Bank Zapadny, and lots of people lost their money because they deposited the money in the bank and the bank folded after the Russian laundromat. So these are people who lost their money. So this is not a victimless crime. If you look at what happened in Moldova, the laundromat and the theft of the century, they both and these schemes are actually connected. The theft of the century is the 1 billion that was stolen from three Moldovan banks. We found that these schemes are connected. this actually affected greatly the pension fund in the country, affected the country not being able to receive foreign grants, you know, aid. And so these are not, this is not a victimless crime. It's people are suffering because of this.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yes, I mean, absolutely agree. But again, this, here's the fascinating thing. Where are these people suffering? They're Moldovans and they're Russians. You know, clearly, it's not going to be the City of London police who are thinking we need to look after the interests of Russian pensioners who were scammed by when Zapadny Bank went down. It's actually the connivance, or at least or connivance, or just simply aggravated refusal to get involved by precisely the source and sort of initial transfer countries, which is the real problem. Russian organized crime, Russian capital flight, all these sorts of things. Ultimately, it's going to be best dealt with by the Russians, and they're not.
They won't.
Precisely. I mean, this is the thing. You actually have the extent to which the state is conniving at screwing itself over.
But I would also argue law enforcement in the UK or elsewhere, I would argue that the this is corroding our financial institutions and corrupting our politics. And I think that in that sense, the West is suffering from this.
Yeah, but exactly. But it comes back to the question of, you know, are you going to put some people onto a case which is of direct and immediate question. Sure, double the size of the police forces and they'll be able to do twice as much, and I'm sure they will be quite happy with that.
Well, on that note, we will shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and take a look at how much of the laundromat is just run-of-the-mill corruption and capital flight of a kleptocracy, and how much of it had a political purpose. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio, keeping us in the Enlightenment zone, is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Buenos Aires, Argentina, is investigative journalist Paul Radu, co-founder of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project and lead investigator on this week's report. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Часы Rolex за полмиллиона долларов.
Оплачивать виллы, яхты.
Деньги эти якобы отмывали россияне,
у которых из России были выведены 22 миллиарда долларов.
Могли обналичить средства, полученные от контрабанды.
Some of the laundered Russian money was used to buy fancy cars. Some of it to purchase furs, some of it paid for elite prep school fees, and some of it was spent on real estate. But at least some of the Russian black cash also seemed to help finance political mischief. Paul, as you noted, and we were speaking off mic yesterday, we don't know the final destination of about 80% of the laundered $20 billion that you documented, which wound up, you said most of it wound up in ghost companies with opaque ownership. Presumably that percent is even higher if, as some reports suggest, as much as $80 billion was actually laundered. Now, all this comes as the Kremlin's active measures in the West are becoming even more active, so to speak. It comes as Russia is suspected of stealthily funding political movements and NGOs and so-called alternative media outlets in Europe that stoke fears about the migrant crisis, advocate a Eurosceptic agenda, and otherwise promote the Kremlin's agenda. It comes amid a Kremlin campaign to undermine Western institutions. Billions of dollars in untraceable cash would sure come in handy. Paul, how much evidence is there that at least some of this money was used for political purposes? Is there any evidence to suggest this? I know there's this one Polish think tank that was documented.
Yeah, so there's one Polish think tank that was run by a former Polish MP, Mateusz Piskorski, who was arrested last year for cooperating with the Russian intelligence services. So he was you know, charged with espionage in favor of the Russians. So his NGO got the money. There's clear evidence that some of the money was used to make purchases for the Russian intelligence and military companies. This is via the company that I was mentioning before, Trident International, this California-based company. So these are the direct connections to advancing Russian interests. But these are just the two cases that we were able to find. There's an indirect one in the sense that one of the important banks involved in the Russian laundromat is the first Czech-Russian bank, which also gave money to Marine Le Pen, National Front. But if we, for instance, look at this case, at the Trident International case, and the connections to the Russian intelligence and Russian military, there's actually a court case ongoing right now in U.S. courts. And what we saw was that the bank account that we identified in the laundromat, that is the bank account involved in transferring a chunk of these 20 billion U.S. dollars, is just one among six other bank accounts. So the operation was much bigger, you know, in this case. So the, and all these purchases were made for the Russian military industries. So what we have is just a small slice of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mark, you mentioned before, just rounding errors here is enough to finance a lot of politically related activities. You and I both know that the Kremlin basically allows corruption to go on and crime and corruption, with the caveat that the Kremlin can reach in if it suits its purposes and use whatever networks it have been set up for its purposes. The famous case that you pointed out recently was the case of Eston Kokver in Estonia, the Estonian law enforcement officer who was investigating a cigarette smuggling ring in Estonia run by Russian organized crime, but aided and abetted by the FSB, which was taking its cut to create a Chernaya Kasa, a black account that it can use for various black ops the Kremlin wants to keep their fingerprints off. This would create one hell of a Chernaya Kasa, just the rounding errors here.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, this is the problem. We have absolutely no idea how much may be directly or indirectly at the Kremlin's disposal. My suspicion is it's actually relatively small amounts, not least because the challenge is, after all, not so much laundering the money as spending it. If all of a sudden we suddenly find sort of fringe political groups have suddenly got 15 million euros to start buying TV adverts, if all of a sudden sort of weird little think tanks espousing a particularly virulent Eurosceptic approach are renting themselves corner offices in Brussels, downtown Brussels, then that's when people start to notice. And this is exactly the kind of thing. It's the same way as, you know, one of the ways that you spot, or you're meant to spot, an intelligence agent who has now become a double agent is precisely to watch if they start now basically driving a bigger car and buying a boat. So in a way, I mean, this is the interesting challenge. Can we, even if we can't, as it were, track the money, can we see any kind of particular footprint that it's out there? And this is exactly, it's worth mentioning, this is precisely the area that intelligence agencies can do and are, in fact, looking. Anyway, no one cares if the money, well, yes, people care, but no one cares that much if the money is flowing through. They do care if it's stopping in their country, in their jurisdiction, and doing something. And the very fact that this is, after all, something that has been going on since 2011.
Yeah.
And we haven't already sort of had these cases of people thinking, good Lord, all of a sudden, there's this sort of magic invisible money has just suddenly appeared. Where has it come from? We've seen small amounts. But the trouble is, you can buy a lot of mischief with 10,000 euros here and 25,000 euros there.
That's what I think is happening. I mean, I think you said, wouldn't it be weird if a bunch of weird NGOs were... Well, they are. They are. I mean, look at all of these strange online websites that are popping up here in the Czech Republic that are mysteriously promoting a Eurosceptic agenda and stoking fears about the migrant crisis and promoting anti-Americanism and, well, not explicitly being pro-Kremlin, just being there's certainly suspicions that's happening. These things are very opaquely funded. They're very opaquely funded. And this is happening not just here, but all over Europe. They're very opaquely funded. It's hard for a lot of people to track down who owns these things. And this is happening throughout Europe right now.
As I said, I mean, I'm actually...
And like
I'm,
you said, 25,000 euros here, 25,000 euros there.
So even if... Let's say, and I'd actually be surprised that if it's that difficult to track down where the money comes from. But let's say, I don't know, 10 places are getting 10,000 euros in the Czech Republic. And let's say 100 places, 100 sort of websites and so forth are getting it across the EU. Still, I mean, the fascinating thing is, in terms of these quite extraordinary sums, it's nothing. So I think this is it. I mean, I'm not saying I don't think it happens. I'm saying it's quite interesting that actually we haven't seen a lot more. Now, I don't know. We have to accept the limitations. Is it that because somewhere there is a great metaphorical sack of cash that they would love to be able to spend, but haven't yet worked out how they can spend it in an effective manner, which is entirely plausible.
Right.
You know, I mean, in some ways, this is a little bit like the problem that at first they found when the Communist Party started sort of stashing money away in the latter years of Gorbachev. Right. So is it that they have money there, which means that it very much behoves us to try and find it before someone works out how to use it, or frankly, people probably steal it? Or is it in fact that actually, yes, we're just talking about frictional sums of money from what is essentially a huge capital flight network?
Well, my suspicion is the people that designed this designed it very cleverly, and I expect that if there is a political motive to use some of this, they're going to design the way they use that end of it pretty cleverly too. And this kind of death by a thousand cuts, using little bits of money to stir up as much mischief in as many different places as possible, because there is the underlying goal of kind of undermining European confidence in itself.
See,
I know
I
you're skeptical of that.
I don't see that kind of strategy. I mean, I think several things. First of all, I mean, you know, actually, you remember this. If this dates back to 2011, this is before the real kind of
started about 2012.
Sort of started. Secondly, look, I mean, they're much, much less smart and disciplined and focused than that. I mean, I see no evidence of a kind of carefully coordinated strategy. There is clearly a will, a desire, a vision. But the idea that there is some kind of complex plan that someone somewhere in an office in Moscow
I'm not saying that. Kind of along your lines of ad hocism that you're.
But this is it. I mean, I think it's more that people just kind of work out ways of piggybacking. And also, just a final point to make on this: we mustn't forget the extent to which the Russian state and particularly the intelligence services are also deeply corrupt. And I must admit, I can't help but wonder if I was the FSB, SVR, whoever officers who are involved, how far would I be thinking in terms of let's set up black accounts that we can then use to sort of fund political parties and so forth? Or how far am I thinking let's set up a black account so that we can all buy ourselves property in the south of France?
I think both.
Well, exactly, but it's the one drains the other.
I mean, this again gets back to your dichotomy between the kleptocratic and ideological state. Paul, please save us.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there's potential there for a lot of covert type of operations, but I think the influence is much more direct than that. I mean, if you look, for instance, at the Republic of Moldova right now, you see that one of the persons involved in the laundromat, whose name is Ilan Shor, you know, became a mayor of a city in Moldova. So he was one of the beneficiaries of this money, and actually one of the organizers of the other theft, the theft of the century, the $1 billion that was stolen from Moldovan banks. So he got money, and he managed to become the mayor of this city. He actually candidated, you know, while he was investigated, while he was, you know, charged with money laundering and other crimes. So this money can be used, you know, in order to influence, you know, elections and stuff. And this is one direct example. We've also seen, but we can't speculate, we've seen really mysterious payments. For instance, our colleagues at the Czech Center for Investigative Reporting in Prague, together with our colleagues at Dossier in Vienna, at the Austrian Center for Investigative Reporting, we're tracking down this layer of payments. It's actually a few recurrent payments that went to an elderly couple in an Austrian village. So there were payments coming, you know, months and months, you know, to this couple, these old guys. Our colleagues met them, and this guy said, "Oh, this is something from the past. We don't want to talk about it," you know. In a matter of months, you know, the lady died in this couple. So there are all sorts of really mysterious kind of happenings with this money, because it all kind of smells. But of course, we can't prove. I mean, and this is the work that intelligence agencies should be doing, tracking down maybe illegals that were planted in a country and things like this. We can't. I mean, what we can point out to, yes, this money influenced politics at least in one country, you know, and this money went to the NGO that is supporting Moscow's vision in Poland. So yeah, these are you know things that are real. But beyond that, you know, I mean, this is what investigative reporting can do, you know. And beyond that, it's the job of you know other type of people and other type of networks.
Mark, you were writing, I saw.
Yeah, I mean, I think, unfortunately, first of all, Moldova, as an example, is in some ways isn't the greatest, because, unfortunately, however much I love the place, it is kind of slightly teetering on failing state status, alas. But, I mean, yes, I think, but what I would want to put this is in this sort of slightly broader context. And here, actually, I have to make an absolutely shameless plug in that I have a report coming out with the European Council on Foreign Relations next month on the use of Russian-based organized crime in Europe as a tool.
We'll be sure
craft.
To promote that report on this program.
Ah, but there's no harm in getting it started too. But I mean, I think actually we can look at this wider pattern, whether it's smugglers exfiltrating a Russian spy out of Cyprus, whether it's killers murdering Chechens in Istanbul, whether it's actually potentially smuggling guns to paramilitary groups or whatever. Absolutely. I mean, in this respect, we see the extent to which, at the risk of employing an overused word, the Russians are weaponizing the underworld.
You started that word.
I know.
And, on this program.
And I will burn in hell for that. But, you know, in that respect, I think sort of what this really highlights, and I agree with Paul absolutely, and this is something the intelligence agencies ought to be looking far, far more sharply at, is actually the old neat little boundaries between terrorism, crime, and statecraft matter so much less. Back in the Cold War days, we got used to the idea that states used terrorists, you know, whether it was the Carlos the Jackal or whoever. Mm. Well, actually, now I think, you know, we're really having to realize that, in fact, terrorists are, I hesitate to say, the least of our problems. They are terrible, and obviously sort of thinking of recent events in London in particular. But actually, in terms of state-to-state relationships, it's organized crime. Mm-hmm. That is really the big problem. And the more that we see these networks created, whether it's moving money, whether it's moving goods and so forth, actually the more it creates an extraordinary array of opportunities for the intelligence services to take advantage of. And particularly when, as in the Russian case, they are particularly ruthless and morally bankrupt.
Mm-hmm. Paul, did you have something to add there?
No, I think Mark is right on this. I mean, it's an opportunity that intelligence agencies will use, and not just the Russian intelligence agencies. Because also, if you look at the laundromat, you'll see that the setup included Ukraine. And, you know, while, yes, we see that there are differences between the Ukrainian government and the Russian government, unfortunately, when it comes to stealing, you know, they are the same. You know, so the Ukrainian oligarchs and the Russian oligarchs don't care about the conflict, you know, in Donbas. They want to make money, and they will use the conflict in Donbas to make money. So what you see is these criminal alliances that we've seen before in the Balkan Wars, for instance, you know, where you see Kosovars, you know, trading arms with Serbs. So this is something that goes beyond ideology. This is something that goes, you know, beyond political differences. It's just organized crime being organized at the cross border level, you know, which nations are not.
Now there's something interesting, Paul, before we wrap up, that I noticed in the report, and that's the countries the money ultimately landed in. And you have a nice little graphic there in the report on that. And what couldn't help but jump out at me was Estonia. The amount of money that ended up in Estonia. It was the largest landing place. What does that say? Because I couldn't quite wrap my head around that.
Well, I mean, the Latvian countries, and not just Estonia, the three Latvian countries were deeply, deeply involved in the laundromat. Their banking systems were set up for the laundromat, some of the banks there. So what we see is Estonian, Latvian, Lithuanian banks, you know, handling lots of the cash. So the money that went to Estonia didn't stay in Estonia. Uh-huh. It went further than that. Okay. So Estonia was just as Latvia, a hub on the money transfers. And if you look again, I mean, obviously these three countries have quite a sizable Russian population.
Nice. Yeah.
So they offer banking services to Russia. And they have offered banking services to Russians for a long time now. So they have a tradition in that respect. And the Russians were just using the banking enclave that they were providing, okay, you know, to get the money into the EU.
Mark, did anything jump out at you about the destination countries here? I mean, I couldn't help but the Estonian case jumped out at me.
Well, again, I mean, just to piggyback off the Estonian case, I mean, and as Paul said, it didn't stay there, but the way that money laundering works is clearly you are essentially trading up and up and up the scale of legitimacy. you sort of first move it into fairly sort of dodgy jurisdictions where you can actually move your money in quite easily. And then bit by bit, you move up. And so
it's like a pre-wash cycle.
Exactly. So this is a case where, you know, if you look at a country like Estonia, on the one hand, it has good rule of law, which is great after you've had your pre-wash, because actually that protects your assets. But also it actually has, you know, a banking system that is actually well connected into the global financial systems. Mm. But when it comes down to it, after all, you know, where are the greatest money laundering hubs in the world? They're places like London, like Dubai, like Frankfurt, like New York. All the money seeks to flow into these most well connected and most powerful jurisdictions. So, I mean, in this respect, the money flows essentially follow the time-honored pattern of carefully climbing up that ladder. Because once it passes through those big jurisdictions, it is pretty much spotless.
Mm. On that note, we'll wrap it up today. That's all we have time for. The report is called Exposing the Laundromat by the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. If you haven't read it, please do so. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio, keeping us in the Enlightenment Zone, has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Buenos Aires, Argentina, has been investigative journalist Paul Radu, co-founder of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project and lead investigator on this week's important report. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
Pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.